I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Desire. It's natural and necessary human emotion. It brings couples together, helps parents bond with their children, and it might even get you that new car or the raise. But sometimes desire can cross a line into addiction. And that's our discussion today. We have here in the studio Adam Brooks. He's a senior research scientist at the Treatment Research Institute, and he's here to talk about some new approaches to addiction. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us by phone is Mark Lewis. He's a developmental neuroscientist presently at Radboud University in the Netherlands. He's written memoirs of an addicted brain, and he's working on the biology of desire, why addiction is not a disease. It's due out in the spring. We also want to hear from you, your stories about coping with addiction, yours, your loved ones, recovery, and how to handle the holidays. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
In your self-portrait, Memoirs of an Addicted Brain, you said that you stole drugs, forged prescription, used black markets for heroin and other drugs, you've overdosed, been arrested, and you have betrayed loved ones over and over. So tell me, how does a nice boy from Toronto wind up like that?
It sounds like you read the book.
This is public radio, Mark. We do things like that.
How did I end up like that? Well, the way a lot of people end up like that, it was through a series of major and minor disasters in my life. The big turning point for me was boarding school. I think for most people who get into serious addictions, you'll find that there is some period of suffering, whether it's depression, or deep depression, or anxiety, or both, or trauma of some sort. For me, it was kind of all of the above. And then I ended up in Berkeley, California. It was 1968, and it was like, okay, this is better than boarding school. Yeah. And I went, you know, directly to the nearest dealer said, let's see what you got.
Yeah, we might have bumped into each other back then. I was touring through Berkeley looking for the same things you were back then.
Would I have recognized you?
Yeah. Listen, though, our last show, we talked about desire and how it increases over the holidays. But I want to start with the bigger picture and how pleasure is so available and so immediate. Everything from food to sex to alcohol, drugs, even, you know, one click on Amazon Prime and you have your goodie the next day. The availability of dopamine is everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess addictions to substances and gambling and other behavioral addictions are a lot like that, isn't it? The instant access is a pretty important part of the pattern. And yes, society has caught up in many ways. So a lot of the things that, quote, normal people do resemble the addictive spiral in a lot of ways. People want immediate rewards. And so they spend much of their time kind of shopping around, where's it going to come from? Where am I going to get it? And there's a feeling of emptiness or craving even for getting something soon. And that's fairly similar to the experience of substance addiction.
What's the difference?
Well, there's a lot of differences to chemical addictions, like drugs and alcohol. Let's see. I mean, you know, in a way, there's not a big difference because we have found now that behavioral addictions, like porn addictions, for example, sex addictions, eating disorders, involve exactly the same neural changes as do drug and alcohol addictions. So given that, it doesn't really matter whether you're taking a substance which suddenly packs your synapses, your receptors, with some interesting molecules, or whether you're watching porn unfold on your monitor. Either way, similar brain changes are taking place. So you're right, there's not a big difference.
Adam, I want to hear your take on this dopamine issue. You said that with addiction, the reward system is exhausted by the craving cycle. You got to explain that.
Jump on something Mark just said. You know, the whole problem of behavioral disorders that relate to the dopamine system is that they exist on a continuum. Some reinforcers that people are going to encounter can be much more intensive than others. So, you know, a good sandwich triggers your dopamine system. Making a purchase on Amazon.com does too. Looking at your smartphone is a reward for a lot of people, which, you know, you can almost sort of think like that becomes a little bit addictive. You find yourself automatically reaching for it in moments whenever you're down. With somebody who is really starting to teeter, where their behavioral issues are beginning to teeter into addiction, is when they're unable to access any other competing reinforcers that trigger that system for them. So,
for example?
Well, so you kind of see this in the narrowing of intensity for like the gambling addict, where suddenly family relationships, a good television show, doesn't do that for them anymore. They're not feeling pleasure from those things because their system has been so hijacked by the more intensive reinforcement or the more intensive dopamine release that comes from the gambling. That's a high that they're chasing or an experience that they're chasing, which ordinary run-of-the-mill human reinforcers don't compete with. And I would say, along with what Mark was saying, you know, when you talk about what an external chemical like cocaine or heroin can do is really flood the system with an amazing amount of dopamine release, and then you wind up with an experience that, for some people, if they're genetically predisposed to that, get on a path towards chasing that down, and they just keep chasing it.
Mark, would you agree that that's the distinction, genetic predisposition, between somebody who uses a really powerful drug like cocaine or even crack?
Would I agree?
Yeah.
You're asking? No, actually, that's not the way I see it. A lot of people take cocaine a few times and they say, eh. And then the 20th time they take it, they start to say, wait a minute, this is kind of nice. And the 40th time they take it, they say, this is really nice. And the 60th time, it's the only game in town. So that doesn't sound to me like a genetic sensitivity so much as a building learning curve. We start to enhance the value and importance of a particular activity. And indeed, I do agree that other activities become less and less valued in comparison, and that's a big part of the process. But the work on genetic vulnerability so far is pretty messy, and so I tend to look at environmental factors. And I also look very much at the learning curve. I think addictions are developmental processes. The reward becomes more and more intense. Even heroin, first few times, it might not mean very much, but after a while, and you stop pursuing other things because you have enhanced its value to a very high level and told yourself that this is really what does it for me, and then it does more and more.
Well, you mentioned environmental factors. There's something I need you to clarify here. So, you know, you went through all of this in your youth with Berkeley. You were in Europe for a while. You were really, really down and out. And yet, at the same time, you were wondering about your brain. You were examining your brain. So, you know, what makes you different from the guy who, or woman who just stays in the street? You know, you were able to examine your brain in the midst of all this and go become a well-respected neuroscientist. How are you different?
I didn't actually examine my brain in those days because I didn't have the tool. I didn't know anything about the brain. But I did examine my thoughts and kept a lot of notes on my experience and tried to work stuff out, kept journals and tried in different ways to quit and finally succeeded. A lot of addicts do quit. The statistics depend on where you get them. I mean, they vary. But anywhere from one-third to three-quarters of addicts to drugs and alcohol do eventually quit. And many of those, at least half, actually, I know this is surprising, quit without any treatment, without any formal treatment.
How do we know that?
Well, there are studies, like the National Epidemiological Study of, let's see, I can't remember, alcohol-related. Anyway, the acronym is NESARC, so you can Google NESARC. With alcohol, the number of them who quit alcohol dependence without formal treatment is roughly 75%. So some people find that astounding, but if you think about it, you know, there are alcoholics, there are people who become alcoholic for a while, and then by the time they're 40 or 50 or even younger, they say, this is not for me. A lot of people become dependent on alcohol in college days and then give it up. But anyway, I don't think I'm a singular case. For me, I got out of it through my own kind of self-taught therapy, meditation, trying to gain insight, talking to myself in different ways. I mean, it was a period of great suffering for me, as it is for many people who have serious addictions. And that suffering motivates you to really want to stop. And then you eventually find a way to do it, because it's just so damn boring if you don't, and so destructive.
Mark, you have it. I'm sorry, Adam. Yeah. You have a take on what Mark said?
So much of what he's saying, I mean, I completely agree with. I'm not surprised about the NESARC findings either. I mean, I think they're fascinating. So many people really do, recover. There was another term that's been used for them in the past called spontaneous remitters. Mm-hmm. People that just, they make choices that cause them to either walk away from the problem one way or another. I think the other thing to consider, too, is, we use terms like addiction and we use terms like alcohol dependent or drug dependent. And, it sounds like, oh, well, that's the worst of the worst. But in reality, there's a lot of room on that continuum. Where I've worked with clients who, formally they meet their requirements for alcohol dependence, but they're on the mild end of the spectrum. And how they go about addressing the problem is really different than the person who is physiologically dependent and, really needs a lot of specialized help or intervention, in the form of, pharmaceutical help or, psychiatric help too. So I think a lot of times it's what you kind of had in your as a resource when you walked into the problem. How challenged were you in a lot of other ways, both socially and environmentally and psychiatrically prior to the problem developing? Because some of those are the resources that you then fall back on when you're in the recovery process.
I want to ask both of you this phenomenon of hitting bottom that everybody talks about. Regardless of what that means, there is a point with so many where you just have to make a decision that I need to stop this. And I used to treat addictions in another life, and I knew right away who was going to do well and who wasn't. It was the ones who came to me and said, I need to end this. I've got to stop this. And others wanted to negotiate whether or not they wanted to come into treatment or do it less often. Mark, I wonder if you experienced that in the course of your development there. Was there a point where you said, enough is enough?
Yes, but unfortunately there are probably a couple of hundred of those points.
Yeah.
All right, so I'm sure you experienced this in practice, in clinical practice, that people want to stop, they try, they fail, it's called relapsing, and then they try again and they try again. And the business of hitting bottom is, I think it's got a lot to it. I think once you've tried 50 times and failed, some people, and it goes back, I think, yeah, I agree with what Adam said about the resources that you bring to it. Some people have, let's just say, more reliable resources for pulling their lives together, and that could include family resources, mm-hmm. It could even include, having some money in the bank or having a family that is willing to support you through a difficult period or help you get back into school. Those kinds of resources are tremendously valuable when you're in that no man's land between, trying to quit and finally quitting. And then, hitting bottom really does help because there's a bounce, and it can get so awful that you just can't stand yourself, and you're so full of self-contempt and self-disgust that you just say, the urgency of quitting grows with each time. And for some people, that can actually wipe them out because they become hopeless. But for others, it can work as a stimulus.
You know, many years ago, I interviewed a woman on the show, and she was her diagnosis didn't matter, but she got out of another psychiatric hospital, and she checked herself into a hotel room, and she decided she was going to take her life. So she's sitting there on the bed with a razor in her hand and her wrist exposed, and she said to herself, I could end this all right now or not. It's in my hands now. And she decided to live. So, you know, this hitting bottom phenomenon is almost like when you make a choice. You have a stark choice, life or death. And when you feel you have the power to make that choice, that's the beginning of change there.
That is true. I'd love to hear Mark's take on this other phenomenon that I see too, of, you know, and I'd love to hear what you think about this, Mark, of, you know, you certainly, and I've come across this with a lot of clients that I've worked with where, you know, they go through this period of recovery and it seems like it's, you know, a pretty strong recovery. It lasts for a few years and then a relapse comes along later. And as somebody who's not in recovery myself, but just works with clients, I often, you know, wonder about that experience of like identifying this earlier period where I hit bottom. I did a lot of work to put life together, back together, and then down the road hit, you know, got re-addicted, got re-dependent. And, you know, that's where a lot of times when we talk about with clients, we talk about it being a chronic illness or it's a chronic relapsing illness. And I know, Mark, your take might be a little bit different.
That's you must have read my interview.
Oh, sorry. Oh, am I ahead of you?
Yeah. Sorry. Because that's exactly where I was going. And Mark, so is this a disease and is it relapsing and remitting?
Yeah, well, obviously I don't think it is a disease.
Right.
The title of my upcoming book is The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. So that's pretty clear. I see it as a learning phenomenon, a developmental phenomenon, somewhat like learning other deep habits in one's personality, learning to be aggressive, learning to be violent, learning racism. They're habits of thought and feeling as well as habits of behavior. So the learning is deep. It's not just in one modality. It's learning a whole style of being in the world, including the way you think about things. And I think that can explain what Adam was saying, relapses over some period of time. In fact, I think it explains it better than the disease idea. Like, why should a disease just happen to relapse one particular day? I mean, is there a virus going around, or, you know, is it exposure to something, or what? And it doesn't take much. It can be an internal thought process that gets you to think, well, you know, I'm in good shape these days, and everything's okay, you know, I could have a drink, why not? So it doesn't have to be exposure. And what I think can explain it is that when you learn patterns very deeply, they don't actually go away. You build new patterns around them, new synaptic networks, new networks of connecting brain cells that give you access to different ways of being in the world, and you practice them, and you strengthen those networks, and you live by them, and you're careful at first when you need to be careful, and after a while you might be less careful. But it's like seeing an old lover after, you know, 10 or 20 years, or even thinking or dreaming about an old lover. That person, if you've been really connected to them, isn't gone from your brain. It's just that your life doesn't include them now. But it could. They're still valuable to you.
So apropos of that, I want to ask you both one question before we have to take our break. Abstinence. Let's hear from you first, Adam. Is it necessary for everybody? What about going back and having a drink or smoking a joint?
Well, you know, boy, you really put me on the spot early in the show, Dan.
Yes, I did.
You know, it's interesting because, first off, we've got to remember that these problems exist on a continuum. So there are people on the lower end of the scale who, you know, their problem gets out of hand at some point in their life, like the college student who drinks. Maybe the college student who drinks way too heavy and the college student who, at that point in their life, might meet criteria for a substance use problem. Well, you know, like Mark is saying, you take them out of that learned environment and they moved on to the next environment where they're learning quite a bit their next job. You can't drink like that and still maintain a job. And so for many people with that sort of an issue, they scale back their drinking. They learn. And no, they don't become abstinent. And those account for a lot of the people Mark is talking about. When you're talking about the person at the much where the addiction has gotten so severe, very few people can then scale that back to moderation. But it happens a lot more than we realize. I think the urban, the common knowledge is that you can't. It's just impossible.
That's AA. I mean, it comes out.
Absolutely. It's, yeah. And furthermore, AA is, it's helped so many people. It's a wonderful resource. And that's sort of the common message in there. But, going back to the studies that Mark is referencing and other studies, too, of people who've sort of remitted spontaneously, the number I'm plucking out of the air is about 1 out of 10 people with more severe problems can scale back to something a bit more moderate.
That's good to know, and I want to put that in context. We do have to take that break. When we come back, I want to talk about treatment, what's out there, what the options are. And, Mark, I want to talk to you a little bit about what exactly you engaged in that was helpful for you. We're talking about addiction today on Voices in the Family, and we're doing it with Adam Brooks, a senior research scientist at the Treatment Research Institute here in Philadelphia. Mark Lewis is a developmental neuroscientist. He's written memoirs of an addicted brain. He's working on the biology of desire, why addiction is not a disease. It's due out this spring. Our number, 888-477-9499. We'll be getting to your calls right after this break. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I want to hear about your history or your family history of addiction, what was helpful and what was not helpful. Please give us a call. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Friends Life Care supports WHYY. Friends Life Care is a member organization designed for people between the ages of 40 and 81 who want to remain independent in their own home, whatever the future holds. Membership provides financial security and professional coordination of future services. A nonprofit Quaker-based organization since 1985, Friends Life Care offers educational seminars throughout the region. Details at friendslifecare.org. Friends Life Care. Security. Vitality. Independence.
Well, thanks to the more than 2014 member pledges we received recently, your friend and mine, Mrs. Dodo Hamilton, will make an additional contribution of $25,000 to WHYY, and all of this support will be reinvested in the kind of programming you expect from us. This is Bill Morazzo. And in addition, WHYY is going to purchase meals for families in need in our region through Philabundance. Please visit WHYY.org to learn more about membership. Have a good holiday.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about addiction today, a new take on it, and new treatments with Adam Brooks and Mark Lewis. Let's go right to the phones here. We've got Jamie on the line from Baltimore. Hi, Jamie.
Yes, yes. Hello. Good afternoon, everybody. And so I appreciate the program. It's actually a sensitive topic to me, So I appreciate it. It's not often that I could speak to someone who's been, from one end to the other. So anyway, my father, so I'm the child of a former addict. He's deceased now. And so he was 37. I'm 35 at the moment. But anyway, he was 37 when he passed away. And I was only 14 at the time. And so pretty much since I was about, I guess about 10 years old, I knew, I understood his habit and I knew what was going on because my mom, she was honest with me, And so I could tell with, with the swollen hands and, different things. I could tell, when he was high and, when he wasn't, when he was going through withdrawals and all sorts of things that a normal 10-year-old doesn't go through, And so, that's painful in itself because at that time, learning about addiction and all, in school, you see the the outcome is either, you're dead or you're going to jail, you know. And so by the time I was 14, though, I kind of stopped worrying about it because I said, well, he's been doing this for a while, you know, and he's got it under control. And then, bam, you know, he ends up overdosing, and that was it. So I had always kind of struggled with the fact of the overdose itself because, you know, being young, you're taught, you know, suicide, you know, so I had trouble with that, you know, whether it was like, is that suicide or was it, you know, or is it looked at as a mistake, you know? So all of these kinds of things, being a kid, you know, you're, you know, it's baffling, you know, it's just going through your mind constantly. And so it's troublesome, you know, but then I learning, you know, knowing his history and understanding his life and the kind of things that brought it on, I guess I kind of saw it more of a disease and like he was medicating that. And just briefly, it's because, you know, when he was 12 years old, his younger sister, she was only 8.
Well,
and her dress caught fire. She burned in their family house.
I want to come back to I'm sorry for interrupting you. The business of, you said a disease and he was medicating himself. When you began to realize that, did that change something for you?
It did. It did. It gave me, because at first, okay, I guess at first, I kind of looked at it as it was like, you know, kind of selfish, you know, I'm like, you know, because I understand my father lost everything he had, you know, behind heroin, you know, he lost our family, you know, at first, you know, he worked 2 and 3 jobs and everything was great. You know, we were kind of living high on the hog. And then, you know, it was like once this took over, the better part of him, we lost everything and he lost everything.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sorry.
I'm still stuck on that, that you saw your father as having a disease that needed treatment and heroin was the treatment. And I, if you don't mind, I'm going to turn to Mark about this. I know you don't consider it a disease, but I wonder if we could view it as a man who was suffering terribly, and this drug, he was going to this drug to help eliminate his suffering.
Right, yeah. No, I'm glad to speak to that. Yeah, Jamie, I think that the confusion is the drug a medicine or is the drug a disease? Like, and it's true that a lot of people who get into heavy drugs have, as I say, have been suffering, whether through depression, anxiety, poverty, unemployment, you name it. I mean, extreme alienation, having very few options in life. There's a lot of ways of suffering. And then drugs make you feel better, and booze makes you feel better, and so forth. So you start doing it as a medication, and we know of that as the self-medication model of addiction. It's one of the main models of addiction. The irony is that the medicine that you're taking, which actually does, you know, it's like antidepressants. It's like a lot of legitimate drugs that people take to make them feel better. But the irony is that the drug that you take to make you feel better becomes the source of your anxiety more and more because you begin to realize how badly you need it, how difficult it is to get, and how much damage you're creating to yourself and others. So it becomes the source of suffering and anxiety, and then it's a closed spiral, a closed loop. It makes you suffer, but you have to take more to ease the suffering. It makes you suffer, have to take more. And that loop is what's so destructive in heavy addictions.
I would want to come in here for James and to focus on the suffering, that this is all born from a man who is suffering. And that's what changes your life when you can begin to see your dad or you can see any substance abuser or addict as a man or woman who is suffering. I think that changes everything. Adam, what's your take?
Well, I think one other, by the way, James, thanks for sharing that. I mean, yeah, it was really powerful. One of the things that we also can't forget is that, you know, certain substances, you know, affect the body. You become physiologically right. dependent on it. It makes it very difficult to quit heroin, opiates, and alcohol in particular. I think the other thing, you know, some, you know, small comfort I can offer here is that, you know, when you get really deep into an addictive process, you know, it really does sort of constrain your choices in a lot of ways. You know, your ability, it affects the brain and your ability to make good decisions. And I can imagine as a young person sort of looking at a grown man who you respected and who'd done for your family and then done good things for your family and then look at this and say, like, how can you make these choices? And I think that's where, just getting back to the sort of the theme of the show about is this a disease, you know, whether it is or isn't, and by the way, you know, I kind of lean more in this direction of it being a behavioral disorder that has a lot of, you know, antecedents and things that, you know, contribute to it. And which is why I'm glad to be on the show with Mark, is though it's so frightening and it feels so out of control. And I think sometimes putting that label on it allows a family member like James to sort of step back and say, well, I can see all these ways that my dad's out of control and it's not all his fault. And you can give a little bit of grace or a little bit of quarter in those circumstances rather than just making the individual own everything that's happening.
Right.
And I think that's where, you know, whereas a lot of times we look at it and say there's aspects of thinking this is a disease that are not helpful, there's other aspects where it gives comfort.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think that's a very good way of putting it.
I want to switch gears. And Jamie, thanks so, so much for the call. I want to talk about treatment here and what the research is showing, what works and what doesn't. You alluded before a break to 12-step programs, and we know thousands and probably millions of people that have been helped through 12-step programs. We don't know the ones who didn't fit with 12-step programs or didn't like it or relapsed. So I want to know what's available for that population of people.
Well, you know, just from a, I'll speak briefly and let Mark jump in on this. You know, I mean, honestly, 12-step, which again I have great respect for because it's so available and it's so inclusive of anybody that wants to use that approach.
And cheap.
It's free. I mean, it's everywhere. You know, it doesn't work for everybody. And what I've also noticed in clinical work is that it works to a certain extent for some people that engage in it for a while, and then they sort of step away and find something else to fill the void that not going to 12-step did anymore. But look, you know, I'm a cognitive behavioral therapist. That's my expertise. And, you know, when we've sort of compared cognitive behavioral approaches to 12-step approaches, they do just as well. So in some ways, you know, hearing what Mark sort of did for himself, a little bit about what he did for himself is not dissimilar to going through a cognitive behavioral remodification program. You know, so there's great, you know, there's super therapists that, you know, deliver a treatment from a cognitive behavioral strategy. There's new medications for both opioid addictions and alcohol addictions that are FDA approved and available for patients.
They're FDA approved. What about their real efficacy?
Yeah, so Adam? I mean, it really depends on compliance and engagement. So for example, we have buprenorphine and methadone to assist people who are coming off through an opioid addiction. And they're there to sort of take the place of the heroin. And in fact, you know, for all the health benefits that one gets from switching away from an illegal drug and getting on to something that maintains you, they're quite efficacious. It can be hard for patients to then make the transition to that.
Off of methadone.
And out of the lifestyle that a heroin addiction encompasses. I mean, you might be on a new medication and then, you know, but you sort of miss, again, apropos to Mark's comment, you miss the old lifestyle.
Right. Right. Mark, what's your take on medication?
Yeah, I agree with pretty much everything Adam just said. And it's true that the opioid replacement therapies can be useful, but they're not an answer for many people. It's, you know, there's a lot of approaches to treatment. Some people do need some detox if the drugs they take have severe withdrawal symptoms. A lot of drugs don't have severe withdrawal symptoms. It's harder to get off many antidepressants than it is to get off alcohol for many people. And cocaine doesn't leave withdrawal symptoms, but people still, you know, it's still a strong chemical. But anyway, I think Adam and I both take the sort of cognitive perspective. It is great because it's free, but indeed the outcome statistics are not wonderful if you base them on the people who walk through the door, what percent get better. There's other free treatment support and treatment group groups available, such as SMART Recovery. I forget what the acronym stands for, but it's basically cognitive behavioral, and it also includes some mindfulness and kind of motivational interviewing techniques. These are techniques from contemporary psychotherapy. Mindfulness practice has been around for obviously thousands of years. Meditation, mindfulness, a very useful approach, and SMART Recovery includes mindfulness techniques as well as cognitive behavioral techniques, the kind that Adam was talking about.
The reason I asked you to say that twice is because I want to make sure our listeners heard it, and I want to make sure we do our research and get that link up on our web page. We're going to have to take another very short break, and when we come back, there's lots of people who want to join the conversation. We're talking about addiction with Adam Brooks, senior research scientist at the Treatment Research Institute, Mark Lewis, a neuroscientist, and he's written memoirs of an addicted brain. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Supporting WHYY, Devereaux, one of the leaders in behavioral health care, helps to provide care for children and adolescents with mental health challenges, as well as individuals of all ages living with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Across its national network, Devereaux helps provide meaningful care to individuals and families where they need it most. Whether it be through community and educational programs, employment services, foster care assistance, or individual or group living support. Learn more at devereaux.org.
I'm Jeremy Hobson, and here's something you probably didn't know about your favorite Christmas songs.
White Christmas, Santa Baby, The Most Wonderful Time of the Year, Winter Wonderland, I'll Be Home for Christmas. 12 of the 25 most popular Christmas songs were written by Jews.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about addictions today and some new treatments that might be available for addicts and their families with Adam Brooks and Mark Lewis. Let's go right to you, Adam. Let's talk about more treatment, what treatments are out there, because when we talked to you earlier before the show, you said... And you're coming from the CBT perspective, you said the following. If you can get a well-trained clinician with, so what do you mean? And how does a consumer decipher who's well-trained and who's not?
You're really kind of hitting the nail on the head there, Dan, because I think one of the issues is that for so long, addiction has been sort of a segregated part of American healthcare. Kind of off, if you have an addiction, nobody else wants to really work with you. They want to send you to a rehab, which historically and culturally, our rehabs have largely been dominated by a 12-step approach. So you're kind of sending people off to the specialized care where they're getting the same thing that they would have gotten if they'd gone into a 12-step meeting. That is slowly shifting. I'm starting to see examples of more and more rehab facilities that are deciding to make a bigger break with 12-step and to sort of found themselves on a cognitive behavioral strategy that integrates psychiatry and medicine in a different strategy. The other thing I want to highlight, I didn't want what Mark said to be missed about mindfulness-based mm-hmm. approaches. We have this new wave in CBT therapies where mindfulness is being integrated into CBT or mindfulness taken as its own approach. And these are becoming more and more popular with clinicians to provide, and they have pretty good preliminary outcomes for handling addiction.
Oh, my God. The early research is so impressive.
I'm really excited about it.
And this is, Mark, this is where I first discovered you, was at the Mind and Life.
Right. Yes. By the way, I should mention there is actually, the mindfulness-based treatment for depression, anxiety, chronic pain that was initiated by Jon Kabat-Zinn, and there's many now different programs and therapies available. There's now a mindfulness-based relapse prevention for addicts, which is being spearheaded by Sarah Bowen in Seattle, and it's it's not only integrates mindfulness, it's based around mindfulness and meditation training.
And
it seems to be very, very effective for addicts.
And if we Google mindfulness-based relapse prevention,
we will find it.
One of the issues, Dan, is that you know, the field of research is so far ahead from dissemination and practice. And I think that's where people struggle, is when they have a loved one who has an addiction. Mm-hmm. You know, they go to wherever their insurance recommends that they go to. They go to, you know, a family friend may have recommended a place. But not a lot of consumer decision goes into how people decide where they're going to send their loved one. And then when you go there, you get what you get. I mean, the program, whatever they have to offer, that's what you get. And sometimes the decision feels so high stakes, family members don't ask a lot of questions. There's actually an excellent book, and I'm going to blank on the title right at the moment I need it, by Ann Fletcher.
Inside Rehab.
There you go. That's the title, Inside Rehab by Ann Fletcher. She does an amazing job of looking at what goes on inside of America's rehabs, and where she actually personally visited many of them and looked at what they offer. But she has this super chapter where she teaches family members how to be better consumers about addiction treatment, how to think about the cost, how to think about who they're going to hire to do it. How to be smarter about putting together something for a family member.
Well, you know, I'll address this here to the physiologist here, the neuroscientist. You know, when you're looking for treatment for your addiction or a loved one's addiction, you know, you've got this whole limbic system engaged here. You know, you're in crisis, and you know the idea of sitting back and thinking about it is not on your radar.
And unfortunately, people in the rehab industry have taken full advantage of that. They know you're desperate, and they're very happy to charge you $10,000 or $15,000 or $20,000 to help you with your desperation, whether or not they have good outcomes. And they usually don't measure them, by the way.
Right.
So books like the one that we talked about, Inside Rehab, are very important, and we should recognize that. First of all, you know, family members cannot do it for the addicted person. They can help, they can be there as supports, but they can't do it. The addicted person has to do it for themselves. And that can help to alleviate the desperation a little bit. You say, don't fully take on that responsibility, but stand there as a support. Then I think you can slow down a bit and think more clearly.
Let's go back to the phones. Al, let's get Deborah on line 4. Hi, Deborah.
Hello, how are you?
Okay, what can we do for you?
Well, I wanted to call in. This is a very exciting topic. I myself am a hypnotherapist with 26 years in the field, and I recently trained with a woman named Wendy Friesen, who created theaddictionproject.com to become a relapse prevention coach. And Wendy is kicking this off in 7 countries, January 1st. It's an exciting alternative to the 12-step programs out there, because we're using the newest brain research materials, science, and so forth to, you know, about the neuroplasticity of the brain to create new neural pathways in the brain that are positive. And unfortunately, the 12-step programs have helped a lot of people, but their percentages aren't so high. And what we're finding is that people who use our program are having much greater chance of becoming relapse free. So I wanted to mention, I didn't hear it mentioned, and I'm excited to get it out there.
Well, that's I appreciate your call. I'm going to follow that up with both my guests who might know some of the research with hypnotherapy. But I wanted to comment on something Deborah said about the number of people who haven't been helped by 12-step programs. We have no idea. We really don't, because, you know, it's an anonymous organization. They don't allow research. There, you know, there's no surveys. You know, what we know is what we know anecdotally, and that hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, really have been helped. So I don't want to throw 12-step programs under the bus. There's an awful, awful, awful lot of value in my own personal family. I've got people who have been helped by 12-step programs, and I've been helped through Al-Anon. I was in Al-Anon for several years, so I don't want to throw that whole thing under the bus, but it's not for everybody. Mark, do you know any research about hypnotherapy?
No, don't worry, I don't.
Okay.
But with AA, yeah, well spoken, and there is some outcome research, but they do it themselves, and they're actually fairly stringent, maybe too stringent, though they sometimes get a success rate of about 5%, and that doesn't sound very good. But as I say, they measure it in a fairly severe way. One relapse means you haven't made it,
right.
And that's not necessarily the case.
Right.
Hypnotherapy? No, I don't. Maybe Adam does.
Adam?
Yeah, you know, with the 12-step stuff, I actually do research with 12-step, and there are clinical approaches to encourage people to get into 12-step. And when you apply those clinical approaches, you get similar outcomes to like cognitive behavioral therapy. So I think sometimes it depends on how the person was introduced to or involved in 12-step. Some of the outcome research is wackily done, so I don't want to get too into that. Regarding hypnotherapy, honestly, I also have not really looked at the literature. One of the things that I would say is that, you know, particularly at the Treatment Research Institute, we advocate and push for research that, you know, has been conducted through randomized controlled trials where we know for sure that the intervention delivers something stronger than placebo and hopefully something stronger than an active comparison condition. I have not personally reviewed the literature on hypnotherapy for addiction. It's, you know, it's certainly got possibilities and potentials. I'm not going to deny that.
She used a phrase that I think all of us can sign on to, and the phrase was rewiring the brain.
Right.
And that's what all of this stuff has in common. So how do we rewire our brains? I'm throwing out a softball to both of you.
Well, I loved Mark's metaphor of, you know, in recovery, you have this old addiction highway, and then you're building a new road around that highway. And, you know, I think honestly, a lot of it is it's practice, practice, practice. It is you're literally taking new steps, new behaviors, and then you're trying to lay down new foundations for a pathway you're going to go down. That was pretty fuzzy in general. I don't know, Mark, do you want to kick in on that?
Yeah.
I think practice is extremely important, actually. And of course, recovering addicts get to practice every day, sometimes all day long. And there's some really cool research that was published, I think it was last year in PLOS One, showing that there is some research showing that there is a loss of gray matter, which means a loss of synapses in some parts of the brain with years of addiction. It doesn't mean your brain is diseased. It really means you're not using certain parts as much as you should. This research shows that people in recovery after about up to 8 to 12 months of recovery show regrowth of other synapses, overlapping areas, which then go past the initial baseline of loss. And so they show synaptic growth beyond where they started or where normal, what the normal baseline is for those who have never been addicted. And that study really brings home the notion that you are indeed building gray matter. You're building neuronal connections through activities, through the way you're thinking about stuff, through inhibiting, changing your focus, changing your perspective, continuing to change it, talking to yourself, talking to other people in a different way.
You're changing
your brain.
There's so many things we do that can get to this as simply as, you know, if you stay off for a day, you know, see yourself as experience gratitude, experience a sense of accomplishment, gratitude journals, formal meditation practice, CBT practice. There's and acts of generosity rewire the brain. You know, there's many steps in the 12-step program that I think are brilliant. I mean, one of the steps has you going back and giving back to others as part of your recovery. It's brilliant.
I think the other thing is that, you know, I'm not sure about the brain science on this, but clinically, getting other people involved in your recovery, getting support, getting help, 12-step does that so well, and I think that's one reason why it is such a go-to for people, but there's other ways to organize that too. Having people reinforce for you, helping you plan a little bit, helping you think ahead just matters a lot.
Yeah, and it's almost impossible to do alone. I've got a important question, probably a final question for both of you, and that's, we started the show thinking about, these are tough times for people during the holidays. I'll start with you, Adam. What advice would you give people who are having a particularly hard time?
Boy, as best you can, don't isolate with it. Try to, you know, whether you're in a fellowship or whether you've got supportive friends or family members, you know, get those feelings out there. You know, share how you're doing. And the other thing is, too, I think if you're a family member, you know, and you have a person in your family in recovery, is to realize it's going to be stressful on them. It's going to be stressful on you, and the best you can to kind of, you know, limit, you know, the amount of imbibing that you're doing is helpful.
And make sure you're both pulling the oar in the same direction here. Yeah. You know, Mark, do you have any advice for people who struggle during the holidays?
Yeah, I would say that if you can't take your drug of choice or drink of choice because you can't, because you know that you're going to go all the way back into addiction, then make sure you have other rewards available. And I don't mean something vague. I mean really specific. Get 5 of your favorite kind of novel or movies that you can watch on your laptop, you know, after the guests go home, something at the end of the day that you can look forward to. It's really important to have something positive and warm and embracing to look forward to, because otherwise the world can feel pretty empty.
Well said. And that comes back to what you said in the very beginning of the show about finding alternate rewards for your brain.
Yes.
You know, you've got...
I like planning. He recommends planning, and I think that's one of the things that can be difficult for people early in recovery is the planning ahead.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, don't just wait for it to drop in your lap. Put it in there.
That's great.
Very good.
That's
point.
Great. I want to thank you both so much. It's been a valuable hour and an important one for so many of us. Mark, thank you for joining us. And Adam, I want to thank you. I know your mother's listening. She should be very proud of her little Adam.
I knew I shouldn't have said anything.
So you can follow us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. Email us at voices@whyy.org. Check out my webpage, drdangottlieb.com. I'm teaching new courses and new lectures. The engineer has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Lindsay Carfagno is our intern. Larry Roebling produces Voices in the Family and directed the show. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week.